Andrew, you missed your song, some secret comments.
Yes, that's true, yes. We'll pass on that anyway. Shall I start?
Yes, please.
I'm allowed to start. Okay, good. Right. Okay, well, thank you for the opportunity to give this talk. What I thought I'd do in the spirit of this program is, rather than go into great detail on any of these single topics, I would review a number of topics and hope to start a discussion on some of them. So by all means, interrupt if things aren't clear and ask me to explain. So this is the kind of object I'm going to be talking about. There's a black hole, or very often a neutron star. It would be important to compare with binaries containing neutron stars. There is a donor star, which I've drawn as red because it very often will be a low mass star, but I want to consider some important cases where it won't be a low mass star. And normally we see such objects as X-ray binaries, and that's through the accretion. There is mass accretion going on, and of course in this workshop, this program, we're very interested in the way in the mass gets down there and actually through the disk down onto the black hole or the central neutron star. So one of the first things you have to ask is, why do you get mass transfer at all in these systems? And as I'll hope to make clear, there are basically two reasons. One of those is that the star may expand. This star just gets bigger, and therefore, since it's gravitationally more attracted to the other star, material essentially falls off towards this orbiting object. Or the other thing that can happen, slightly less obvious, is this whole configuration can get smaller because it loses angular momentum. And of course, one of the classic ways in which it might do that is through gravitational radiation. So there are two sort of connections back to the kinds of things we're interested in this program. Just a short general consideration, which would be quite important for what follows. Of course, the reason that binaries are awfully easy to deal with is that almost always you can measure the binary period, and that immediately gives you a very good idea of how big anything is, and that's a huge advantage over most branches of astronomy. As a rough rule of thumb, if you have a period, and these will very often be of order a few hours, then for a system whose total mass, M, is of order of solar mass, you've got a separation about the solar radius. So these can be quite small objects. Some of these, I mean, there are systems with periods of only a few minutes, and some, of course, at the opposite extreme, you get periods of years. But what that tells you, since I think intuitively it's clear that the donor must occupy a large fraction of that orbital separation if mass transfer is going to occur, that as soon as you know even the binary period, which you can, as I say, nearly always do, as soon as you know that, you've got a rough idea of what the donor star must be like. If it's got a very long period, you know it must be an extended star. If it's short, then it can't be. That will be important in seeing how these systems came to be and what's going to happen to them. Well, then just a technical remark about what happens during the orbital evolution. Mass is being transferred within the binary, and if you look at the expression for the total angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, you logarithmically differentiate, and you end up with this expression, assuming that everything that left star 2, and it will always be star 2 that loses the mass in this talk, everything that left star 2 was gained by star 1. Then what you find is that there's this equation telling you how the separation changes. So if we leave aside for the moment the possibility of angular momentum loss, and we just look at this term here, this is positive, and you can see that the sign of the change of the separation, and therefore period, in fact, the sign of that change is determined by whether you're transferring from the more or less massive star in the binary. And this is of fundamental importance, because what it says is that if you transfer from a star that's more massive to one that's less massive, then the binary separation tends to shrink on the timescale of the mass transfer itself. And that's a situation that very often the binary cannot tolerate. It's actually too rapid for things to proceed in an orderly way. And that's the meaning of this remark down here. Stable transfer, you generally want the opposite thing, that is M2 less than M1. And I'll come back to that point later on. Without the dots, yes, I just realised they shouldn't be. What happens then when you've got the mass transfer? This is well known to many of you, but let me just go through it for completeness. Let's assume that the donor star fills the critical equipotential, the so-called Roche lobe. Mass will flow towards the mass-gaining star, M1, down here. And if you take a cut through the potential, say along the line of separation, rotating with the binary, then it's got a saddle point in the middle. And that's the crucial thing, that the star fills the Roche lobe, and you can imagine, say, a mountain valley with a high mountain pass to another valley next to it. The star filling the Roche lobe is like the lake that just fills up and then overflows into the next valley through that pass, and that pass is the so-called inner Lagrange point. And so the material comes from the donor star with a very well-defined stream and therefore well-defined specific angular momentum. And it will generally come across on a time scale that's given by angular momentum loss or expansion for some reason, give you a mass transfer rate of that order. And the very important thing for this program is that that specific angular momentum we know is far too large for its orbit, its ballistic orbit, to intersect the mass gaining star. So it always goes into orbit around that for anything more compact, at least as compact as a white dwarf. And so you always have the situation that you must form some kind of accretion disk, and in that process, because angular momentum is harder to lose than energy, there's a tendency for these things to form nice regular disks. Not always, but quite often. So that's where the importance of all that comes from. It's also, I think, pretty obvious that reaching this stage, I'm just saying we've got this stage, reaching evolution 2, the X-ray binary stage, is not straightforward. For example, just one very obvious fact, since the separation of these things is quite small, periods of a few hours in many cases, they are of order of solar radius, or so, in separation. That is far smaller than any likely progenitor of the compact star. So something dramatic must have happened to the binary to get it down to that size. And if the star we're looking at is a neutron star, things are even more delicate, because, as we know, neutron star formation requires a supernova with a very large mass loss. And if you just take a circular orbit with a supernova that's completely symmetrical around the exploding star, if you lose half the binary mass in the supernova, you will unbind the binary. The binary will not be a binary, it will be two objects flying apart. And so you can see there's some fancy footwork required to retain the binaries you actually see. You know they're there, so it must be possible. It is obviously possible. Theoreticians, being ingenious, have found ways of doing it. Nature obviously knows how to do it, but we're not quite as ingenious. But the bottom line of all that is that to get a neutron star in a binary is a rather delicate operation, because there's this fundamental tendency to break the thing up when you form these binaries in the supernova. The constraints for black holes are much weaker, as far as we know, because the mass loss is likely to be much less severe, essentially. And so there is much less tendency to unbind the binary.
So, do you mean to say something about statistics?
I'll come on to numbers in a sort of anecdotal way in a minute, but if you bear with me, then perhaps ask your question again. Well, perhaps I ought to say how we know that any of these systems have black holes at all. Well, the reason is that many of them are transient, and I'll come on to why they're transient shortly. But what that means is, observationally, these are systems which were not seen by X-ray satellites at all for many years, been no detection, and then suddenly the system switches on and becomes bright. And then after a year or so, the system goes back, decays away, so there's very little X-ray emission from it. And that might be thought to be a bit of a disadvantage. In fact, it's a great advantage for one particular thing, namely, once you've identified the object as an X-ray source, a transient X-ray source, once the X-rays go off, you can now do work on the optical companion, which you cannot do during the bright state. You're outshone by the accretion disk.
So black hole binaries are more often transient,
yes,
than neutron star systems?
Yes. I'll come back to that. That's very important. The transits are both types, but black holes, transits seem to like being black holes. Both. So in the X-ray off states, what you can do is look at the donor star, which is now simply looks like an ordinary, usually an M-dwarf or something, orbiting a companion we cannot see. And that's a classic situation where you can get a single line spectroscopic binary. And because it's absorption lines you're looking at, there is no danger that these are gas streams or something not connected to either of the stars. You get perfectly clean dynamical mass measurements. And of course the quantity you isolate is the so-called mass function. It's this combination here. You're looking actually at star 2, but you tend to measure the mass of star 1 because that's the thing that's slinging this star around in its orbit. And in several cases this mass function here, which is directly observable, involves the cube of the radial velocity amplitude and the period. That quantity itself, which as you can see is clearly a bound, a lower bound to M1 itself. The worst that could happen is that that thing would get as small as M1. That was M2 would be 0, and sine cubed I would be 1. That quantity alone is in some cases actually larger than the mass of any likely neutron star. So it's an absolute rock bottom limit, which you simply can't do anything about, and because you know that the thing was an X-ray source, you're really stuck. This cannot be anything but a black hole. And the number of systems like that, of course, you can get cleverer and start to try and make estimates about the inclination. But the number of systems we know of where the black hole is pretty well certain is about 7. And I would say the ones where we're absolutely certain are all transient. There are some other systems which are steady where the case isn't quite so watertight as it is for the transients. Well, as we remarked already, there are relatively few neutron star transients. They do exist, and comfortingly, there are two different ways of deciding whether something is a neutron star. The first is to measure the mass, and Senex-4 is an example where you can measure the mass and you find it's consistent with something no more than about 1.5 solar masses. But the other comforting feature about this is during the long X-ray outburst that lasts for months, there are what are called X-ray bursts. These are much shorter things, and they're thought to be thermonuclear burning on the surface of a neutron star.
Just moving up to the previous.
Sure.
You're saying, of course, Cygnus X1 is sort of marginal because the mass function is, what, 3 or something like that?
No, it's 0.25. Yeah.
Right.
The problem there is that the donor is a great big massive star,
yeah,
and therefore hardly moves.
Yes.
Because the unseen object is not bigger than it.
You don't know the inclination.
But you can make clever arguments, and Paczynski, I think, made this very clever argument in the late 60s or early 70s, which tend to bound the inclination in such a way you get a mass which is marginally inconsistent with the neutron star. But that case is much more delicate. Yeah, there's several elements in this.
Well, one thing that one might try to do to get a better bound on the inclination would be to look at this one-sided jet that's now been discovered.
Yes.
Because you assume that this pair of jets, yes, and the asymmetry is,
yes,
due to beaming. It's a lower limit,
yep,
on the half phase on it.
Absolutely. And there are all sorts of ways where you might suspect that other systems have black holes. Yes. The SS-433 is another one.
That's also clever.
But the point is that this argument is absolutely childishly simple. There is just nothing you can do except say that star is more massive than 7 or whatever. And in fact, the typical mass tends to be of order 7 with quite wide error bars.
Let's see, if you return to your blue bullet, you said there are two ways of telling something is a neutron star, but there's the zeroth way, that it's an X-ray pulsar.
That doesn't seem to happen in any of the transients.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So there are a fair number of systems that are known to be neutron stars through these arguments that are
observed. I should say there's a second class of transients, mm-hmm. which makes this more historically. The ones I'm talking about are called soft X-ray transients for historical reasons.
Yes, right.
There is another group called hard X-ray transients, which are all neutron stars. And they consist of neutron stars in a very eccentric orbit around a large BE star. And every time it reaches periastron, you get a burst of X-rays lasting a few days or weeks.
But those are X-ray pulsars.
Those are X-ray pulsars, and you can get a timing orbit in many cases for that pulse. There's one at a very short period, really weird object discovered by Beppo Sachs, period of 2 hours, and it's the first object to violate Walter Lewin's famous phrase, which is pulsars don't burst and bursters don't pulse, because this one does both, but it has a very weak field apparently, and that's this very weird object altogether. Coming back to these, the two ways you can tell that something is a neutron star is, one, the mass, and two, these thermonuclear bursts, which require some stable and small surface of very high gravity on which to occur. And it's very comforting that when you do all the methods that are used to get the black hole masses, all of those guys, which then have the small mass, turn out to have X-ray bursts quite independently, and so there's quite a lot of confidence that that method of doing everything is really correct. So there are two questions then which have been raised. One's been raised. The first is, why do we get outbursts at all? Why are these things transient? And why is there this apparent preference for black hole systems? Well, the resolution or the answer to that is again something which is of great interest in this black hole program. That is that the transient outbursts are now strongly believed to be connected to the fact that the accretion disk itself is unstable in some sense if it is cool enough to allow ionization zones. Yes, indeed. I will not go into any detail about how that works, and I'll simply ask you to accept that if that is true, you do get outbursts. As I say, that would be could be a series of seminars all by itself, but I think that is that bare fact that if you have ionization zones, then you're likely to be unstable, I think is universally accepted. There are endless arguments about the form of that instability, but I think it's hard to see now that this is really wrong.
And the reason these don't occur in neutron star systems is that the accretion disk in neutron stars is further out?
It's more stable. I'm going to show why I think it's more stable.
Okay. Hydrogen
ionization? It doesn't in some of them, the ones that are persistent. But I'm going to try and show why. Well, you can see that this immediately gives you a way of guessing which kind of systems are going to be unstable if you know how they evolve, if you know how they transfer mass. And you can see, just take the standard expression for the effective temperature of an accretion disk. And since you're looking for cool regions, you want to look at the largest radius here in the disk. And you can see that if the transfer rate is high, sufficiently high that even the edge of the disk is bigger than about 10,000, temperature is bigger than about 10,000 degrees, then you will not get ionization zones. And so if you take that simple criterion, you can predict that some systems will be stable, but some with low mass accretion rates will tend to have outbursts. And that simple picture in this form works very well for the white dwarf analogues of the systems I've been talking about. These are not X-ray binaries, but they have a white dwarf instead of the black hole or neutron star. Those are the so-called dwarf novae, and I suspect that Jean-Marie must have talked quite a bit about dwarf novae.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, okay. That's where this theory is most fully developed, and it seems, I think, it's commonly accepted that this is quite a successful explanation, although there's a great deal more work to do. So we're happy then, at least with the occurrence of dwarf novae in white dwarf systems. Why is it different in these X-ray binaries? And this is something that is a good example of something that observers will tell you for 20 years and theoreticians will conveniently ignore because they think the effect is too complicated. And something that is small change amongst observers is that the accretion disks in X-ray binaries are too bright compared with the X-ray emission, too bright in the optical. That is, if you use the central X-rays as a way of predicting or measuring what the accretion rate is, and go back and compute this effective temperature here, the disk is not bright enough. There is extra radiation heating the disk, or something extra is heating the disk, and it's pretty obvious what that must be. It's actually the central X-rays somehow returning. There's a small solid angle subtended by the disk, and their faces then are heated by what is either, it should be concave, not convex, concave or warped disk. So somehow some of that radiation is returning and hitting the surface of the disk. There's all sorts of the strong, I think, argument for that is there's a very strong correlation between the excess brightness and the total flux, X-ray flux, that the disk can intercept. Given by this, you know the size of the disk roughly because you know the binary period. And so those two things correlate very well. And you can imagine that that is going to make a difference to this stability property, because irradiation then might raise the temperature of the disk, and indeed might crucially push the temperature above this unstable value of 10 to the 4 degrees, even when the transfer rate is lower than you would expect. And you would draw from that the conclusion that systems with black holes or neutron stars in them should be more stable, that is, less likely to have outbursts than equivalent white dwarf systems. And indeed, that is true. At first sight, you would think, I've thrown out the baby with the bathwater, I've made it all stable. But as we'll see, that isn't true. There is actually a difference as well. There appears to be a difference between black holes and neutron stars. Apparently, black holes are less stable than neutron stars. This stabilizing effect is weaker, apparently, for them. How can they know what the central object is? Well, possibly through its mass, but I suspect that there is another difference. Namely, remember, what you're doing is saying, could there be a steady state in which the irradiation kept the disk stable? If the irradiation is relatively inefficient in a black hole system, then the stabilizing effect is less.
And the complication on that is if you have corona.
Yes, I'll come back to that. Yeah. But what we're talking about here is the hypothetical steady state that could exist. Okay. So the question is, could the system in a steady state develop a corona around a black hole? If it does, then it will just look like this. It'll just look like a neutron star. Be no real difference. It has a heated central object, and that's radiating like a point source and irradiating the disk reasonably efficiently. And this is an effect pointed out in the very first paper by Shakura and Sunyaev about accretion disks, that you would expect, if the black hole doesn't develop a corona, that all you've got as the irradiating source is the inner disk. Now, the luminosity of the inner disk, of course, will be comparable with that release at the central object. There's really no difference in the gravitational energy release in these cases, factors of a few. But crucially, the geometry of this surface is quite different. This is now a flat object lying in the orbital plane, lying in the disk plane, and it's harder for it to irradiate the surface of the black hole. So that is the suggested, almost childishly simple reason for a difference. But remember, we are talking about not an observed state here, that's the problem, but a hypothetical steady state. If that were to exist, then the thing could remain stable. And so just some examples of how this all fits together. I don't know if I can get all that on. Along here we've got the orbital period, logarithm in hours. So these are short period systems, as you see, 10 hours, 3 hours. And these are calculations of the mass transfer rate. This wiggly line here with the two drops in it is calculations of the mass transfer rate expected for various angular momentum loss processes. In fact, at short periods, this is dominated by gravitational radiation. But as you heard, I think, in Jean-Pierre's Blackboard seminar, in fact, this part of the longer period is actually more complicated to say what the angular momentum loss is, but we have some ideas. Now, the crucial things are these blue and red lines here. These are the lines for some sort of guess at the geometry. These are the lines at which, if you were above that line, if the transfer rate is above that line, then you are stable, that is, you keep the disk hot and stable against this ionization instability.
Without any irradiation?
No, this one is without irradiation.
The top one is,
yes.
Okay.
And the middle one is it says it down here, the middle one is the critical rate for a black hole, and the bottom one is for a neutron star. And you can see that there is a difference because of this H over R factor. There is actually a difference between these two criteria, and you could try and convince yourself that for 10 solar masses that the predicted rates lie squarely between these two. In other words, you would expect most neutron stars at these periods to be persistent, and that's what you see, and most black hole systems at these periods to be transient. That's also what you see. You would still expect some exceptions. That is, you see some neutron star transients at short periods. And that is something of a puzzle, but it's probably related to the fact that these I've assumed to be main sequence donors.
What paper is that?
That's from the one with Shushkevich and Kolb. Right. Me, Shushkevich, Kolb. I can give you the reference at the end. But,
In all cases, the companion star has been taken to be just big enough to fill the Roche lobe.
Yes. In all cases, this is a low mass, main sequence star filling the Roche lobe, dragged in by angular momentum. Now, you remember I said that a neutron star transient, or neutron star binary, is a rather rare object. Well, that has an important effect, that any neutron star system you look at is actually an oddball. Something funny happened to make it. So you shouldn't be too surprised if it has extreme conditions. So what this crude theory predicts, and there are all sorts of imponderables in this, and Jean-Pierre can tell you about some of them to do with how efficient the irradiation is, for example. What you crudely predict from this is if you take a black hole and a main sequence star, you'll get a transient, that is, assuming that the orbital period is a few hours, less than a day. On the other hand, if you take a neutron star and a main sequence star, that will apparently give you a persistent source. That is, the irradiation will be efficient enough to keep the disk stable. And that is quite reasonable, because we actually know in several of those neutron star binaries that the disks are rather big and warped. That is, it looks as though they do it actually intercept a large amount of radiation. On the other hand, if we've got a very long period system, it really doesn't matter how much you irradiate the disk. You can't do better than the Eddington limit in a steady state. So if you've got a very wide system with a very large disk in it, then its edges are bound to be cool. And so if you've got a long period system, which is what you will get if your donor star has evolved off the main sequence and become a giant, for example, then there's a very strong tendency for those systems to be transient. And indeed, that's what we largely observe. If the donor is a low mass star, red star usually, and a long period, 10 days or more, then virtually all of those systems are transient. And you can turn that round and say there must be an awful lot more of them, because we only see the transients when they go off. The recurrence times here may well be longer than an observer lifetime. They could be centuries. So there could be huge numbers of long period transients, probably quite a large number of short period transients out there, which we haven't seen or won't see, because they just won't go off while we're around to detect them. I should say that observationally you don't miss transients now. The coverage is too good really to miss them, unless they're extremely faint, of course.
For these long period transients, how long is the outburst?
It's longer. They've all got e-folding times which are related roughly to the orbital period. But, for example, some of them go on for, well, there's one that's gone on for 6 years, effectively. So that we don't know the orbital period there, but it must be extremely long, just to fit that size of disk in.
It also happens with short periods, like O7 for H, which has been outburst for
Yeah, 0748 has somehow managed to do this, so something strange has happened to it. That is a neutron star transient, but with a period of only about 3.8 hours. Now, to explain that at all on this theory, you have to say there's something different about the secondary star there. It cannot be a main sequence star, despite the fact it's got a very small radius. It must be have been, for example, one possibility is that it was actually a nuclear revolt. It's actually gone off the main sequence, but then it's been pulled in by angular momentum loss and become a short period system. And then, its radius is larger for its mass. And this has a strong tendency to make the mass transfer rate lower and therefore make the system more transient.
How much of the radiation coming out of X-rays gets reprocessed?
Oh, tiny fraction, because the disk is not a. Not a huge solid angle.
10%.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah. All that.
Yeah, unless they're all warped.
Well, I think the. But observationally, that factor is never huge. At the point. That's the. That. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, just enough. Yeah. So
10%.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
But I was going to comment on the point made by Mitch, because it's not clear why there should be a difference between black hole and neutron star, because now the fashion, as you know, is that everything, all X-ray come from corona.
Yes. So well, once the thing goes into outburst,
right? And all this is a work.
Yes.
No, that work.
That's the next question.
Yeah. Once the thing goes into an outburst, then these things don't look very different at all.
Yeah, but then the H over R factor, it comes from a flat disk. Like,
yeah. I think the answer is to that we just don't know. But you know, the only thing I can say is that there has to be a difference in the irradiation, clearly.
Sure.
And we see that they are irradiated. Steady state disks and disks and outbursts
in your
are all irradiated.
The subject which was connected with the evolution and with the transfer rate, depending on the
for neutron stars. I think the object of that was that it's very difficult to understand why neutron stars are transient. So you have to appeal to a change in the evolutionary state. There is a small tendency to make black hole systems more transient merely because they're slightly more massive. So they're slightly wider, but bigger disks for the same period. And they have lower transfer rates, actually, black hole systems, because the total angular momentum of the binary is higher. And therefore, it's harder to shrink the binary. So J dot doesn't. Actually, that's subtle because if you go to very large masses, it grows. You make the GR rate bigger, so you can actually turn the rate.
Just say for black hole, if you're going from a 2-solar mass black hole to a 6-solar mass black hole, the critical transfer rate.
How does the transfer rate change?
The critical transfer rate is going from say 2 to 6.
Oh, hardly. These you can see from those those lines don't really move much. It's the curves that move. You see that. You notice this side's come up here, right?
Okay, that's probably more.
That's because the GR rate went up.
The more relevant question.
This side's actually gone down.
What's the typical difference between the transfer rate and the critical rate as a function of black hole mass? Is the more critical question.
So the only difference in three lines and one panel is that you change the amount of radiation hitting the disk.
No, the only difference is the mass of the accretor.
No, but I mean
these three, yes. This is exactly, yes.
And as you said, it's all from gas.
Yes, definitely. And you take a number of order H over R for the disk, and you assume that that's of order 10%. That H, of course, is something like the warped disk rather than the actual scale height.
So are you going to go into this issue of irradiation and H over R and all that in more detail?
No, I will not go that into more detail on that because Jean-Pierre, I think, could give you a whole seminar by himself on it.
Mine's an interesting point.
Oh, yeah?
Well, from that diagram, it looks like all 2 solar mass black holes are stable.
Yeah, but there aren't any. But there aren't any.
Maybe there are 5 solar mass black holes aren't. Yeah, it could be that.
It could be
a few candidates. The idea being that for Phil Charles' diagram that he shows where he's 6, that you just never see the 2 solar mass black holes because, one, they never give you a burst or X-ray pulsar. two, they never get paid enough to measure their mass function.
Well, I occasionally thought the same myself, but never had the courage to say it. But you know, mass would make a difference.
I kind of see candidates. I think 339 minus 4 would probably be a two solar mass black hole.
Okay.
And B14LA-Achille would be a two solar mass black hole, which is perfectly stable.
Yes.
And that you just don't know it's a black hole because
You can't really. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
This black hole is always dominated.
Absolutely. Yeah, any persistent system, I think it's fairly obvious in my argument, it's almost impossible to get a good mass because the accretion disk always dominates the optical light. So
that funny gap that Phil Charles has in his diagram.
Yes, it could be.
Just that all the two solar mass black holes exist and they're common.
Yeah.
You just never look at them.
That's a fascinating remark, I must say, because I'd never realized there was this evidence that suggested that was right.
So the statement that all black hole systems are fringed
could be completely wrong, that all black holes of a certain mass are transient. You're right, because it's obvious there is some critical mass at which it won't work, below which it will be stable. Okay, so what I thought I would do in the rest of the talk is talk about another couple of things. First of all, the transient outburst itself, again, in the spirit of introducing things which I hope will be things for discussion. The transient outburst in a soft X-ray transient lasts a long time, and it's crudely a sort of decaying exponential. You plot that in log, those are log x, log t. It always has this, or nearly always has this little glitch here after about one e-folding time. But this slope tends to be, in most of them, exponential. That is, in reasonably systems of reasonably short periods, you get an exponential. In systems with very long periods, you tend to get linear decays. The longest one of all, I think, a 12-day binary had an extremely linear decay. And this is in stark contrast to the light curves of dwarf novae, which, remember, are supposed also to be the disk instability, but there, and they've got similar binary periods, so there's no real difference in the size of the disk, there the outburst is much shorter. It doesn't have an exponential shape at all. The thing simply has sometimes a flat top, but then is dominated by a much sharper decay after typically a few days. And the reason one suspects that for the complete difference between these two things is again connected with this central irradiation. Because you can see that once the outburst goes off, then the disk that was previously unilluminated will now be feeling these central X-rays. We know that in outbursts the disk heavily irradiated again, just like a steady state disk. Of course, it will find it impossible to return to the cool state now until the central X-rays have turned off. As long as those are reasonably bright, just the radiation from the center alone will keep the disk hot. Whereas in a dwarf nova, it was the locally generated radiation that had to keep the disk hot. So whereas in a dwarf nova, after a short time, a cooling wave comes across the disk and returns it to the low state, that cannot happen in a transient until the central accretion rate, which is what's determining the irradiation, until that's turned off. But of course, how can that turn off if the disk is still in the high state with the high accretion rate? There is only one way, and that is that you must accrete much of the mass. And you can see, I think intuitively, that's likely to give you something like an exponential, because the m dot is proportional to the mass that you're accreting. And if you do if you integrate the diffusion equation, indeed you get something rather like an exponential. The reason why in a very long period system you don't get an exponential is that you cannot irradiate the whole disk. Remember, that was the reason they're transient in the first place, these long period systems. And that means that as the central accretion rate drops, then so does the region of hot mass, which is supplying you with the central accretion. So I think that is, again, in essence, probably a correct explanation, although people can argue endlessly, again, over the details. There's a second aspect to this whole thing, which I would like to draw attention to. That is, I've assumed that the only evolution going on so far was of the donor star. Can the black hole evolve? In other words, can it change its angular momentum parameter, and can it change its mass? Well, it obviously is changing its mass. It's accreting, and it's accreting angular momentum when it does it. But it's really not very difficult to convince yourself that it's very unlikely that you would raise the angular momentum parameter from some value close to zero, in other words, a Schwarzschild hole, all the way to an extreme or even half extreme curve. This consideration, I think there have been papers claiming on the basis of spectral information that there really is a difference between some black holes and others. Some of them are spinning rapidly, was the claim, particularly ones with jets, and some were not spinning at all, particularly ones without jets. So you can ask, can that have occurred? Is that an accident of birth, or can it have occurred through evolution? The answer is, well, probably not through mass accretion. You do not gain enough mass ever to spin the thing up. Essentially, you've got to double the mass, crudely. And you can see that that's almost never going to happen. Either because the donor star has far too little mass itself to give, it's much less massive, or in the case where something like Cygnus X1, where the donor is very massive compared with the black hole, then the problem is that most of the mass gets wasted and not accreted. Very little accretes. In fact, the system doesn't remain as an accreting binary for very long. And so the mass fraction that is even tiny is really very small in that case. However, you might get that range of A by spin down. That is, you may find it more efficient to start with a rapidly spinning black hole with A close to M and spin it downwards. And how do you do that? Well, of course, we've talked in this program several times already about the possibility of extracting energy from the spin. Bamford's Nyack is the classic example of how one might do that. And conceivably, that spin down could account for an observed range. In other words, it need not be accidents of birth, but just conceivably, the spin down would be affecting it. But there's a very important effect that then occurs if that is true, something that Roger Blanford alluded to in his talk at the recent gamma ray conference, namely that if you spin down a black hole, you're actually reducing its mass. You're taking energy, rotational energy, away from it. And this is the famous irreducible mass that relativists discovered from the area theorem. And you can gain a factor of 1 over root 2, 1 minus 1 over root 2, of the energy, total mass, and put it into whatever this process is driving, say jets or something. But importantly, that means that the gravitating mass of the object is actually getting less. And that affects the evolution of the binary quite significantly. Generally speaking, the usual effect of mass loss with the orbital angular momentum of the mass point that's moving, the usual effect is to reduce the transfer rate. You have to do fancy things to raise the transfer rate. So it could be that in some of the black hole transients where it's not obvious why they should be transient, there's at least one, 1655 minus 40, which we know has jets and is transient, but is frustratingly stuck in the Hertzsprung gap where it should be transferring mass at a huge rate. Seems apparently to be transient. Maybe it's the jet mass loss that's causing this thing to be a lot less extreme than we thought, and therefore, curiously, having outbursts. Well, that brings me on to, in fact, the possibility of reducing M1 brings me on to the what I want to finish off on. Namely, so far I've assumed that the mass of the donor star was less than the mass of the primary, or typically a little bit less than the mass of the primary. What happens if that is not true? Of course, it's quite likely that that will not hold in all cases. Well, as I said, it's often difficult for the binary to deal with it, because from that little bit of a calculation at the beginning, the fractional change in the separation will be negative if you do that. That is, I've neglected there the effect of angular momentum losses, because this is happening on the dynamical time scale. I've moved a lump of mass, delta m, from one side of the binary to the other, and to conserve angular momentum, because I put it further away from the centre of mass, more massive to less massive, the binary's got to get smaller. That's all that's happened. Well, that's a problem, potentially, because, remember, the star was already filling its Roche lobe, and it's now, the Roche lobe has been made a bit smaller. And so, mass literally falls off that star, yeah, I've made the mountain pass a bit smaller, a bit tighter or something, and the water falls out onto the other valley, or that is, it falls onto the black hole. And it does it on a dynamical time scale. The thing is, there are unbalanced forces, and so the thing just falls off. Now, you don't leave a hole at the edge of the star, of course. Matter, of course, by pressure within the star, is pushed back up to the surface. So the hydrostatic equilibrium is restored in a dynamical time scale. So you refilled the surface of the star. The question is, what is that star now, bigger or smaller than it was before? Obviously, if it's smaller, there's a chance it may actually fit inside this smaller Roche lobe. If it's bigger, then things are going to get tricky. And the answer to that depends simply on what the entropy of that matter is. The new matter that arrived, because it came adiabatically, everything's dynamical, it's got the specific entropy of material lower down in the interior of the star. It's just coming up to the surface because there's no matter above it. So you can ask, is that entropy more or less than that of the mass it replaced? That's a very simple exercise. You know that in a radiative envelope the entropy increases outwards. That means the stuff that comes up, this is a condition for convective stability, the stuff that comes up has lower specific entropy, therefore the star is a bit smaller than it was before. In fact, it's quite a lot smaller, it turns out, in a radiative star. So you can see you might just manage to survive in this case. That star is not instantaneously bigger, it's actually instantaneously somewhat smaller. However, of course, that is not the end of the matter, because now you've got this material here, it's got a deficit of entropy. In other words, it wants to absorb heat. And it's easy to see how it will do it. It's radiating less outwards out there than it's receiving from below, from the nuclear flux of the star. And so it will gradually absorb the heat and grow back towards a new thermal equilibrium radius. So on a dynamical time scale, the star got smaller, so there's no real runaway on the dynamical time, but then it's gradually trying to push back to a radius which in general is actually bigger than the original Roche lobe. But you can see from that argument that the time scale for mass transfer will tend to be the thermal time scale on which you push stuff back up here. It will actually in general overflow, but it will do so not on a dynamical time scale, but on a thermal time scale given by the Kelvin-Helmholtz time at the start. That's the case when the star had a radiative envelope, in other words, something like an upper main sequence star. But very often we've got the opposite case of a convective envelope, something like a red giant or a low mass main sequence star, and there things go badly wrong, because the material coming up has got either the same entropy or maybe even slightly more, because the gradient is very slightly super adiabatic, energy is being driven out by convection, and so after mass loss the star is actually bigger, not merely does the lobe shrink, but the star gets bigger. So both things are going wrong, so the mass is now coming off quite rapidly.
This thing is clear for everyone why bigger entropy means expanding and lower entropy.
It's cooler if it's got less entropy, so it wants to absorb heat. So it's, if you make the pressure equal, you find that the density has to be less. That's the way to think of it. That the entropy involves a ratio of pressure and density to some power gamma, and you know that the pressure is fixed on the surface, and therefore the difference in entropy is given simply by the density. And so the stuff with lower entropy is denser and smaller, and so it has to absorb heat and expand.
No, they don't see such effects in the
GM. Indeed. Well, they probably do, but they don't realise it. Okay, but in either case, so here the mass transfer goes crazy, or certainly keeps on increasing for a long time. But even in this, even in the case of a radiative star, the mass transfer rate, remember, is a thermal time scale. For the Sun, the thermal time scale is 30 million years, and so if you had thermal time scale mass transfer there, you would get a rate already in excess of the Eddington limit for a one solar mass star. So if I take a star that's more massive than the Sun, a much shorter thermal time scale, I can get very large rates, even in this apparently relatively stable case. So those objects would be you would worry what would happen. Well, there's one thing that was suggested years ago might happen, I think originally by Paczynski and Ostreicher independently. What could happen is that the star simply can't accept that. The mass-gaining star simply cannot accept the transferred mass. And then what happens is that the whole system tends to be engulfed now in a huge envelope that came off the original donor star, and that's what's called a common envelope. The two stars are going around inside it, that is the black hole or neutron star, and probably the core of the original donor.
You get common envelope situations also from just having a giant compact star, neutron star, whatever, that just spirals into the center.
That's what's happening here. That's exactly
the envelope was produced by puffing up.
Well, if
it's not a merger.
Yeah. You can have both things. You can either have the mass ratio inverted with this problem, or the case I think you're referring to, when the star comes off the main sequence and starts to get bigger. It need not be the more massive star. And in both cases, the mass transfer will go on a thermal timescale. So you can get this common envelope in which there's this now little tiny binary inside it, and it's little drawn as a small binary for a good reason, because the frictional drag of this thing, of this envelope, on the binary is removing orbital energy from it. So the orbit shrinks, and the orbital energy is used essentially to heat or something like that, and maybe capable of ejecting the envelope. And Ron Tam is an expert, and I'll feel all questions on common envelope will be passed over to Ron. But what is thought to happen, obviously this is a complicated situation to calculate, is one of two things. The energy release may eject the envelope, and you end up with a smaller binary. That is, you've got this blue thing now, the core of the old donor and the black hole or neutron star, or the thing just may never be able to eject the mass, and it ends up merging in some form or other, and you may form some odd object like a Thorne-Zhitkov object or something like that. Maybe, but it's inside a large maybe. However, that's what everyone believed, but I think there's a counterexample. A famous old X-ray binary, as you can tell by its name. This is Cygnus X2 now, not Cygnus X1. And this is a counterexample, because here we've got a neutron star, we know in fact in this case, a relatively warm star, about 7,500 degrees, and the binary period is 9.8 days. This is a persistent system, there are no outbursts. There are X-ray bursts from this thing, so we know it's a neutron star. In fact, this is one of the few systems where you really can get good measurements, despite it being persistent, good measurements of the absorption lines on that star, really because it's so wide. And the extraordinary thing that emerges from that analysis is that this is a perfectly reasonable neutron star mass of 1.4. This star, although it's huge, only weighs about 0.6 of the solar mass. It's got an enormous radius, has to have to fill the Roche lobe, and yet and that radius, together with the observed effective temperature, tells you it's got an absurdly high luminosity. It's 150 solar luminosities in a star that weighs about half the mass of the Sun. So something absolutely incredible has happened to this system, and it's fairly obvious, in fact, this must be the remnant of a much more massive star. In fact, there are various ways you might try it. There's only one acceptable way. It would take me another seminar to go through all the other ways of trying to get it. There's only about one way you can really do it. Namely, this star must have come from a much more massive progenitor of about 3.5 solar masses. So the binary got rid of apparently 2 to 3, conservatively 2, probably more like 3 solar masses. It's really extraordinary. It somehow knew how to do it. Was it a common envelope?
So the companion is burning helium definition.
Now the companion now is still, it's a very peculiar object, as we'll see. It's got a very tenuous envelope,
yes,
and it's got shell burning probably going on, just.
And why is it capable of helium?
It's leftover heat. Right, it hasn't managed, it was thermally unstable. this mass transfer, and by definition, the star isn't in thermal balance. Okay, so it's shining on heat that's still not gone.
Still thinks it's a massive.
It still thinks it, the entropy of that layer hasn't changed, and it still thinks it's very hot. It shouldn't be. It will cool down.
Kelvin is finally right after more than 100 years.
In that way, yes. Could this be a result of common envelope evolution? I think not. And the reason is pretty simple. The orbit is 9.8 days. If you work out how much energy you would get by shrinking that orbit all the way down from infinity to 9.8 days, that's far less than the binding energy of that envelope. It could not possibly have ejected that star. So mass has been ejected from this binary, three solar masses apparently, but not by using the orbital energy. And this is something where I started to work with Mitch quite recently on the stimulating effects of this program. And what must have happened in some way is that the mass was ejected. The mass was ejected presumably by radiation pressure, because during that prior evolution, the system even now is transferring at 10 to the minus 8 solar masses a year, the Eddington rate, roughly. But during the prior evolution, it went up to 1,000 times, if not more, for that rate. It was 1,000 times the Eddington luminosity. And apparently, it then refuses to accept any more than just the Eddington rate, which of course is 1,000th of the transferred mass. So virtually none of the transferred mass has settled on the neutron star, and that is nicely consistent with the fact its mass doesn't seem to have changed from the original canonical value of apparently 1.4. And what must have happened is that somehow this material was ejected. It was energetically possible to eject this matter, and you can see there will be a rough equality of that type. There must be some radius from which it's possible to eject the matter. It obviously can't be down at the neutron star, because you would have to have the you don't have enough energy to eject it all. So you can, if you say that you are limited to the Eddington luminosity for 1.4 solar masses, and you say that, well, I know roughly what the transfer rate was, it was the thermal timescale mass transfer rate, then I can work out a radius from which that material could have been blown away. And Mitch can tell you chapter and verse on how you might think about that radius, but I think that crudely captures the essence of what's going on. And the question is, what is that radius? Is it large or small? Because if it's large, then you're back in the common envelope situation. You build up some ball of gas which is then going to interact with the donor, and you'll be back to the same old thing. Is it possible for this ball to be small enough that you can actually blow everything away and still survive as though the other star wasn't interacting with you? And the answer appears to be, in many cases, yes. This is the amazing thing. When you actually do the numbers, even when you've got a reversed mass ratio, which you don't have to have for this situation, as you mentioned, the star in the Hertzsprung gap, the binary will survive more or less with any upper main sequence donor. That it's got to have a radiative envelope rather than convective, which means a fairly massive star, more massive than the Sun. But apparently it will survive even with factors which are absurdly high compared to the Eddington limit, whereas the conventional wisdom used to be those systems will always go into common envelope. And it works for almost any main sequence donor mass. So that is really, I think, a tremendous surprise. Certainly was a surprise to me that the thing can work quite so efficiently, but apparently it does. Well, of course, you'd like to be convinced that this process really does work. So what is it? Is there anything that looks like this process is working? I think there is one. This won't be a surprise to most people. This is the famous SS-433, which is for a 13-day period, which means that the donor star is extended if it's filling the Roche lobe, which it probably is. And if it's surviving at all, remember I said it has to have a radiative envelope, well, you could get a 13-day binary with a red giant, very low mass, but that isn't a good idea because that'll have a convective envelope. So you want something, probably a star crossing the Hertzsprung gap, a massive star that's come off the main sequence and is heading towards the giant branch, but it's still hot enough, it hasn't cooled down, got to the Hayashi line, still hot enough to give you a radiative envelope. That is no ionization zone at the edge. And that's, again, some work I've been doing with Ron, that it looks as though stars of something like 16 to 24 solar masses filling the Roche lobe. Their thermal timescales are frighteningly short, and the masses are high, but nevertheless, this thing, you actually gain, of course, because the binary is so wide. So the radiation pressure bulge that you blow is apparently able to fit in the Roche lobe of the primary. But what that predicts when you do it, and these things, you get these incredible transfer rates here of 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year, beginning to get like a faint quasar or faint Cepheid or something. This thing, remember, is 10 to the 5 times the Eddington limit rate for the neutron star. You are actually accreting, presumably, only that rate. So if it's a neutron star, you accrete that much. If it's a black hole, you accrete that much. There are estimates for the mass loss in the jets, which are of order 10 to the minus 5, so 1% of the wind. So almost everything that comes across is blown away. A tiny fraction of order 10 to the minus 4 or 5.
You probably have to accrete more than that to get the power.
Maybe slightly more. But
well, the jets are point.
Yes, that's why I put that one in. Because
the more than 10 to the minus 6.
Well, then it would have to be 100 solar mass black hole. That's getting worrying. So let's hope it can be done with slightly less.
And you really have such a very nice flat disk in all this?
No, indeed not. I've tried to draw a warp here.
Okay.
Notice? Like that?
Okay,
not easy to do, I can tell you. But what must be happening then, if any of this is right, is that there's enormous mass loss from the disk. Virtually everything that comes in is lost before it gets down to the centre. A tiny bit, 1% or so, gets down to the centre and is ejected in the jets, which we know are precessing. And it may be that the jets simply amount to the dense collimated part of this huge mass outflow. Is there evidence for mass outflow in SS-433? Yes, abundant evidence. But the problem has always been with this system is it's heavily extincted. That is, it cannot be seen in the optical because it's beyond the galactic centre. About 7 magnitudes of extinction. So you can really only observe it in the infrared. And indeed you do see a huge free excess in the infrared, which was always thought to be the stellar wind of this star. Or very often thought to be that. And I'm suggesting instead, in fact, what's happening is that this star is transferring mass and then it's being blown away because it's using the gravitational energy of this object to do it. So that's a rather extreme object, and I'll just in my last view graph point out the consequence of both this and Cygnus X2, in fact. These things have got incredibly short lifetimes. That is, Cygnus X2 might have taken 100,000 years to get to where it is now. It's slowing down now, of course. It's hanging around. But not necessarily much longer than that, in fact. SS-433 is in the act of doing this and can only be lasting of order 1,000 or 10,000 years at most. And yet we see them. So if you have something with an incredibly short lifetime, but you actually see it, it must be a very common process. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, becoming more clear. It now appears there are actually other X-ray binaries that people had assumed were driven by low-mass giant evolution, for example, which probably aren't. The star is too hot to be like that. SCO X1 may be an example. And probably those things, this process is much more common than people had realised. So I will stop at that point and invite questions.
So what's going to happen afterwards?
After
the 1,000 years.
You'll be left with the core of the donor, which is probably a non-degenerate helium core. So that'll make a helium star, and it depends on the mass. I mean, we haven't thought about this, have we? Depends on the mass of that core. Yeah.
Could you see such remnants? Because there are plenty of them.
I don't. It's not easy because they're not going to interact again. You've got a black hole, a non-interacting black hole, in most cases.
Galactic supernova jet sources.
We know that one of those, 1655, is in the Hertzsprung gap. Okay, weirdly it's transient. That's the really, really a frustrating thing about that. Nobody knows why it's transient. No, it doesn't. But of course, during its outbursts, it is extremely super Eddington. All those systems with long periods, when they have outbursts, because they've saved all the mass up and just given it up in a few months, they're wildly super Eddington when they go off.
So can you make here a generic picture for the evolution of galactic superluminals?
I think all the galactic superluminals are probably Hertzsprung gap, thermally unstable mass transfer. The 1915 must be, because the as we know, that's gone on for 6 years, if it had a little dip in the middle. But effectively it's been on more than it's been off for at least 6 years. And yet it was never seen for 30 years, the first 30 years of X-ray astronomy. So that, if that's a disk instability, this must be huge.
Because it does. I think some of them there is a lot more observation, but a lot of wavelengths. So you could test these business to whether the free or whatever.
Yes,
wind.
That's right. Well, I think the 1915 again is behind the galactic center. There is no optical observation. There's not even a period. But it must be long.
SS 433 also has a stationary broad line system.
Yeah, that's consistent with the free.
Consistent with the wind, this mass.
That's in fact how you get the extinction.
And there are also, I believe, there are Doppler periodicities in the lines of that wind. And it was never clear whether those came from the secondary from the disk. And you get different mass functions depending on what you assume. And that's why nobody still to this day knows whether it's a black hole or a neutron star.
It's a black hole. I mean, the system is so massive that it must be.
I guess you didn't go into the fact that did you have persistent in the system?
164 days, yeah. Well, Mitch knows more about that than me.
It is associated with
warp, etc. Yeah, there's a warp disk. There's some photometric evidence for that. And there's obviously this very stable perception.
And remind me, in the other superluminals, there are some other persistent jets?
There are jets.
They're
jets. Obviously.
There's a lot of weaker evidence for precessing disks, and many of which are not don't seem to be strictly periodic.
That's correct.
CX2 actually has it.
Exactly. Is it 80 days or
something?
I think 30.
They all tend to be month long time scales, so they're generically the same kind of time scales as you see in Hertzsprung X1 at one end and at SS433 at the other.
Yes.
But the superluminal jets don't, the other ones don't.
Not as far as I know, there's no claim yet.
They're short lived, the jets. They're usually short outbursts, and I should be really careful, but it seems that
NS620
also has a jet.
Yeah, I mean, any outflow that's not spherically symmetric is called a jet, if you're not careful. But
I think that the Mirabel has some evidence for some periodicity.
Not yet a period.
Well,
I think some motion.
Period, but, yes. Some recurring
pattern. Well, there are other things like the radio knots themselves. Yeah, the radio knots themselves track X-ray events with a delay, which is thought to be in 1915.
There's also sort of a quasi-periodic oscillations in the radio knots, which are very strange because the period keeps changing.
Yeah.
Ranges between. It's got a fairly high Q. So you get a very good coherence for a day or so, and you know, 20-minute period, and then the next day you look at it, it'll be 30-minute period, and then it'll be a 40-minute period.
But that could be some, that's not orbital. It's too short that to be. But the X-rays themselves show a periodicity, a quasi-period. There are times when the light curve looks periodic on a very short time scale, in seconds. It isn't strictly periodic, but it looks it. And the radio flares track the X-ray.
Are there interesting gravitational wave sources for LIGO or Virgo among the early?
You want short period objects. I think that the most likely things that they will find are these short period double white dwarfs, actually, the AM Canben systems, where you have a helium donor and a white dwarf accretor.
Yeah,
they're
sort of
Yes. But that's going to be the background. Because the galaxy is full of those. I think none of these long period systems are at all promising because the periods are just so long. So you want systems that are going to spiral in and get to very short periods. And what's the shortest one we know? Remember, Ron?
For 2 billion, 100 billion years.
So if SS433 were to spiral inwards, that would be quite a good source, but I would have to think more carefully about what happens to the helium remnant. I mean, if it goes off as, if it made a neutron star in a black hole.
Well, depends on
whether
the supernova explosion is asymmetrical.
Well, if SS-433 is a black hole, if it's 10, then it wouldn't, the supernova wouldn't disrupt the binary, so you would have a neutron star and a black hole in a relatively tight orbit. But whether that would ultimately evolve to the point where it became the GR sources, GW sources, unclear. You've got to get them down to a few hours, I think. So it depends on detailed stellar evolution beyond that point, but there could be an awful lot of them. You see SS-433 and it only lives 1,000 years or so, apparently. So yes, maybe.
Yeah, not to the light or frequency.
Probably not, no. No.
In the age of the universe.
Yes. Yes.
Let me ask you about the disk irradiation again.
Mm-hmm.
The model calculations you showed earlier, what did you actually assume about disk irradiation?
Oh, very crudely, we just assumed an opening angle and just calculated the effective temperature at the disk, allowing for irradiation.
Assuming the disk was either flat around a black hole or assuming there was a source.
It's got to have a certain curvature. Now, Jean-Pierre will tell you that's too naive, and he's right.
Yeah, well,
and you can do a much more sophisticated job. But unfortunately, I suspect that the answer is that it's the warping which counts, because you know that an irradiated disk warps. Well, because then the details are less clear.
Okay.
It's not easy to make these simple models.
And then what was the difference between black holes and neutron stars as regards to
that? Simply that in the black hole case, the source is might be a flat disk rather than a central point object, and that the geometry is less efficient by a factor of 8 over R, because it's a flat thing irradiating a flat thing. So for the same luminosity,
yes, okay. so
less of it's going out.
There's
a point source in the middle.
Well, a point source?
Yeah, well, a spherically symmetric.
But
it does, A8 over R.
The size of the sphere doesn't make much difference.
No, for the same luminosity,
yes,
emitting from a sphere
it's just cosine
is, is much better than emitting from a flat plate.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, you make a simple assumption and the answer...
The answer appears to be right, yes.
It's coming out about right.
Yeah, if it didn't, I mean, you'd dismiss it. This would go in the dustbin of history, yeah. But...
people mentioned flares, or coronas anyway, I'm not sure the word flare was mentioned. What is the observed X-ray spectrum in the case of the black holes? It's just
well,
soft, isn't
it? Once they go off,
yes.
And you don't see them at all in X-ray, hardly.
Yes.
Once they go off, they're just rather soft.
Yeah,
they have a hard tail.
That's just, I mean, the tail may be a corona, but the
that's
soft,
right.
The soft
it's totally dominated by
something like a standard.
Yes, yes.
Disk.
You can crudely fit them like that, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.